Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the State Board of Elections votes to allow Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on the November ballot, but not Cornel West. Democrat Nicole Sidman's campaign reports she is vastly outracing her Republican opponent, former Democrat Trish Cotham, in their race for the North Carolina House. Meanwhile, Attorney General Josh Stein is outracing Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson 2-1 in the race for governor. Plus, we hear some of Robinson's speech at this week's Republican National Convention, which took place just days after an assassination attempt there against their standard bearer. We hear from some North Carolina politicians about that incident and that party's convention, which I believe ended. Is the speech still going on? No, it's over now. Here to talk about those stories and more is Steve Harrison, WFAE's politics reporter. Alexandria Sands is here. She's a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Nick Oxner is executive producer of investigations at WBTV, where he is also their chief investigative reporter. And Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning. Welcome to you all. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good
morning. So Donald Trump will be on the North Carolina ballot in November as a presidential candidate, unless something changes in the next couple of weeks. So will Joe Biden. And now we know that at least one third party presidential candidate will be there, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The North Carolina State Board of Elections voted to make that happen, but Cornel West will not be on the ballot. Steve, take us through their reasoning.
Well, the state Democratic Party, North Carolina Democratic Party, objected to both Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Cornel West being on the ballot. The board did feel there was a lot of political pressure growing on the state board to certify them. They ultimately did. But in the case of Cornel West, his Justice for All party, the Democratic majority board felt that there were questions about the people who signed the petition, whether they really knew what they were signing. The two Republican board members on the elections board protested vigorously, saying that the Democrats were overstepping. I think this is interesting, of course, because it's possible North Carolina will be close. Cornel West polls about 1% nationally. Doesn't sound like a lot, but in North Carolina, you know, Trump won it by a little more than 1% 4 years ago. So every vote counts.
State Board of Elections voted 4-1 to recognize RFK Jr.'s We the People Party. And there was some discussion about whether those candidates should have run as independents. Board member Shobhan O'Duffy-Millen said both candidates were essentially using front parties. And given that, she pointed out that independents require six times as many signatures on petitions to get them on the November ballot. Hers was the lone no vote.
If their purpose is just to, quote, get Bobby on the ballot, unquote, or get Dr. West on the ballot, that effort is in actuality an unaffiliated candidacy.
So why didn't other board members see it the same way?
I, like I said earlier, I think one issue is that there was some growing political pressure from Republicans in the state legislature and other places questioning why the state board was blocking the two parties. I remember 2 years ago, we went through this again. We went through the same thing with the Green Party, where the state board voted against her certifying the Green Party. The Green Party sued. They won. It's a tough call in that state law kind of allows for both vehicles. It allows for you to get on the ballot as a member of a political party and also as an independent. Are RFK and Cornel West using these parties simply as vehicles? Probably so. Is that allowed under state law? Perhaps. So that was really the big question mark.
Eric.
I thought it was interesting, as you mentioned, both parties immediately cried foul, but Speaker Moore came out with a statement, and I think this could hint at perhaps some changes if they can find a way to make changes, maybe take away some more powers from future governors. So I think that's something to watch as well.
They've been trying to find a way to make more changes, to Eric's point. If they could find a way, I think he's right, they would, but let's just
remember that the Board of Elections has had about 80 iterations in the last 10 years. Yeah. That might actually be an underestimation, but has had a number of changes for this exact reason. It is very partisan. The governor has prevailed in being able to control who is appointed to the board. And for now, that means that a Democrat gets to pick the majority of the board.
So a Democrat, Alan Hirsch, said he believed that there was subterfuge, his word, involved in the Kennedy We the People application, but acknowledged that a no vote would probably be overturned by a court. So he voted yes on Kennedy, but he voted with two other Democrats on a 3-2 no vote on allowing Cornel West's name to appear on the ballot. The Democrats on the board were concerned about the authenticity of signatures on that petition. 250 people signed it, but Elections Board staff members were only able to reach 49 of those signatories.
So in short, I have no confidence that the number of signatures here have been required by statute have been met.
So for Democrats, there has been concern all along that any third-party candidate will siphon off votes from their party's candidate, Joe Biden. Did that play a role in this decision?
Well, it just depends who you ask. Of course, if you ask the Democrats, they say, you know, absolutely not. This is hewing to the standards that should be enforced. And the Republicans say, absolutely, they're playing politics, trying to protect Joe Biden. So, you know, pick a side and off we go yet again.
And Eric's exactly right. There have been allegations of partisanship on every decision like this, again, dating back forever. That's why you have a very small minority of people who think that the board should just be nonpartisan and should be appointed through a different process that's not overtly political. That will never happen because the people making that decision are overtly political. But this is the issue when you have the system governing our elections like we do in North Carolina.
I was going to say one more thing, Mike. It's interesting, and this was, again, something the case with the Green Party decision 2 years ago. There's this whole chicken or the egg argument that the state Democratic Party was arguing, like, look, well, Justice for All has no apparatus. They have no infrastructure. They don't really exist. And then Cornel West, his group, Justice for All, turns around and says, well, yes, we don't, because we're not a party. We are trying to be organized. And, you know, so they felt like they were kind of darned if they did and darned if they didn't. So I thought that was an interesting piece of the discussion.
So that decision to block Cornel West and his Justice for All, not a party, was 3-2 against with Democrats against and Republicans for. State Republicans have said that the board's vote showed that it acted to help President Biden, and Republican board member Kevin Lewis was incensed by the vote.
Justice for All has submitted well over the number of petitions required. And if we don't approve them as a new party in the state of North Carolina, based on talking to 49 people, I think that would be injustice for all.
Meanwhile, a group called Clear Choice Action pointed to an NBC News report that a Republican activist had been collecting signatures for West's group at a Trump rally to take away votes from Biden. What do we know about that? Not much. Okay.
Pretty much exactly that, Mike.
So we also know that the Justice for All Party yesterday said it will file a lawsuit challenging this decision by the North Carolina Board of Elections not to certify them as a political party. Now, Steve, I believe it was you who just said they say they're not a party. Did they have a leg to stand on here?
Yeah, I think they do. You know, 2 years ago, this happened with the Green Party. They sued. They won. They were on the ballot 2 years ago and will be on the ballot again in North Carolina in November. And like you said earlier, the board chair, Alan Hirsch, said, you know, there's a decent chance that the courts will overturn this. So, you know, this isn't over.
Yeah, and Italo, I think you say his name, Medelius, who's the chair of North Carolina's Justice for All Party, said they were expecting this denial, that it has a legal team ready, the lawsuit has been filed, and they fully expect to be on the ballot in November. After the vote, as I think, Eric, you alluded to, the North Carolina House Speaker, Tim Moore, insinuated that the board could face reorganization to create, quote, a more balanced body. In other words, he wants to lessen Democrats' power on the board. Would that be accurate?
I think that would be accurate. Yes.
How would
I
the
mean,
board...
as Nick said, this goes on. It has gone on
back and forth.
Virtually every issue. This is what it comes down to. Yes.
So, how is the board currently appointed?
It is appointed. Doesn't the governor get the majority of the slots? And so that's how you end up with a 3-3-2, which is what we are now.
And this is ringing a bell, Steve. Didn't we talk about this a couple of months ago, that the legislature wanted to take that power away from the governor and well, to make it less partisan, but in fact to make it more Republican?
Well, their idea was to have basically a equal share. I can't remember the exact numbers of what the board was going to be, but there would be an equal number of Democrats, equal number of Republicans. And there was this fear, well, you would have a number of just deadlock votes. And so what would happen when you have a tie? Would that be kicked to the legislature, which would be controlled by Republicans, et cetera? So, but yes, like Eric and Nick have been saying, there have been talks about changing this for years and years.
Here's the ironic thing, though, Mike, is like 98% of the time, all the votes are bipartisan. Even if they could be divided, but they're bipartisan in their nature. And so it's only when we have these hot button issues like this that we see suddenly the partisanship or allegations of partisanship streaking through. And that's why, you know, the Republicans have been trying to shift it their way.
So the Republican National Convention wrapped up last night in Milwaukee after nominating Donald Trump for a third time and anointing Ohio Senator J.D. Vance as his running mate. On the convention's opening night, North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson followed Georgia's Marjorie Taylor Greene to the stage in the running order to speak for about 4 minutes. Both of these firebrands toned down their rhetoric, joining in that evening's theme, which was that life was much better under President Trump.
Under Joe Biden, grocery prices have skyrocketed and gas has nearly doubled. In North Carolina, factories just like the one I worked at are closing, leaving families feeling hopeless. But there is hope, and I'm proof. My wife and I never gave up. We kept our faith. We worked hard and made it through those tough times. Now I stand before you on the verge of becoming the first Black governor of North Carolina.
Fact check, grocery prices did rise in the aftermath of the pandemic and the disruption of the supply chain. But what about the rest of that? Have gasoline prices doubled? Are factories closing, meaning jobs being lost? Aren't we in a time of high employment and new factories and new jobs coming online around the country and here in North Carolina? Eric.
Mike, yeah. A politician would never use hyperbole.
Yeah, right. He would never do that. He would never overlook the fact that unemployment has been at historic lows or near historic lows the past 3 years or so, of around 4%. So as Nick says, hyperbole has no place at political conventions. So we're shocked by this behavior. I thought what was interesting in that 3.5-4 minutes is that one of the things that the lieutenant governor did was he used his own personal bankruptcy, his own sort of personal financial problems, and turned them around as a story of inspiration of, hey, this is how America can be rebuilt, so to speak. Look at my story. And, you know, it's always interesting when a politician or anyone else tries to take what could be perceived as a weakness and turned into a strength.
We're going to come back to that, because he talked about his wife and I. So that brings her into the equation and the daycare center that they run and the kerfuffle that we are reading about in the papers and hearing about on the radio and watching on television recently in North Carolina as he runs for governor. We'll come back to that. We'll also hear from Nikki Haley before and after the convention and her endorsement of Donald Trump. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup this morning on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison joins us. He's WFAE's political reporter, Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte, Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter at WBTV, and Eric Spanberg, the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. We're talking about the Republican National Convention, which wrapped up last night in Milwaukee, and some of the appearances of local luminaries, including the Lieutenant Governor, Mark Robinson, the Republican running for governor in North Carolina this year against Josh Stein. We'll talk about that race in a moment. But as you mentioned, Eric Robinson, well, we heard the clip. He alluded to his story, his recovery story, his picking himself up by the bootstraps story about he and his wife. At one point, they ran a daycare center here, and it's some question about whether they followed state regulations when they did so. So remind us what that question surrounds and where that case stands, because he says one thing and the state of North Carolina says another.
On the, you were asking about the daycare piece of it specifically.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of coverage about the daycare essentially, I guess, being forced to shut down by the state. And that daycare
he didn't file the proper papers according to the state. Yes. They have no record of the proper papers, and he says that's not true.
It was
go ahead, Steve.
Just jump in real quick. It was in a way it was worse than just not filing the proper papers. This was a daycare in Greensboro that his wife owned and he helped manage. It was that some of the paperwork that they presented to the state said was just made up, was falsified. So it wasn't so much that they forgot, it's that they didn't have it. And then they went and basically created what the state's words were, a falsified document. Now, the Robinsons then sold, with all this problems, they sold the daycare. They're out of the daycare business. But, you know, when you see the word falsify on a state report, that's pretty unusual for government officials to talk like that.
And there were also, I guess, violations found by the state related to cleanliness, safety, nutrition, which, again, when we're talking about daycare center, it is pretty serious. Go ahead, Nick.
Well, just to piggyback a little bit on what Steve was saying, some of these things can get wrapped up in really technical. If you read some of these inspections, they didn't do X thing, even though mm-hmm. that X thing is really, you know, seemingly trivial, but the nature of the things that the state has said about this daycare really are quite big boulders to overcome here if you're running a daycare. And so that's that.
And Mike, if I could just add one other thing, there were also the 5 years of not filing federal tax returns. So, you know, when you look at the financial ledger here, which this has been reported on, and of course, on the other side, Democrats have sort of hammered away at this. It's not a pretty picture. It's not an impressive record by any means when you're trying to be the chief executive of a state.
So is this, when he points to his achievements and overcoming adversity, is this what we're supposed to take away from this, that it's okay to break the law or skirt the details on forms as long as it comes out okay in the end for you? Is that the way we're supposed to regard this? Because if that's the case, the government has become a criminal enterprise.
I'm going to assume that's rhetorical, Mike, but...
No, it's not, actually.
If there's an answer, I think the answer would be that, of course, Lieutenant Governor Robinson feels like he and his wife have been unfairly treated in these circumstances. Mm. They've done nothing wrong, and that they have been resilient. Now, again, I'm not speaking for him. I'm just telling you kind of what
his political conventions. As it has been pointed out, at political conventions, you're expected to hear positive speeches and glossing over things and changing the nature of certain things, because it has to all look bright and shiny. And you expect the people who have received the endorsement of the front runner, which Mark Robinson did, to return the favor. So here's what he said.
Under President Trump, there was hope, and we need that now more than ever. So this November, let's elect the brave heart of our time, Donald J. Trump, to get our economy back on track.
I expect to hear St. Crispin's Day speech coming out of that in a moment. That sounded more like the Mark Robinson, Steve, who a while back delivered the Republican rebuttal to Governor Cooper's State of the State address, and not the Robinson that we hear on the stump or at churches railing on social issues and saying that some people need to be killed, his words. Aside from any political party putting their best face on, is this party, has this party been presenting their people and their views in a disingenuous light?
Well, they've been certainly, I think most of the Republican convention was pretty successful in that it passed, it did try and kind of brighten up the image of the party. The Robinson speech was a pretty good example. I mean, there was nothing in there. There was zero talk of culture war, no LGBTQ issues, no abortion. It was a tight speech focused on economic issues. And then, you know, we go back to last night when in the president's acceptance speech, it began scripted calls for unity, and then it started to go off the rails, and the president began riffing and going off the teleprompter, and it was in a way a very tightly coordinated convention up until the last 60 minutes.
Yeah, and it was that's the longest speech in the history of modern political conventions. The other two, the second and third place longest speeches, also belong to Donald Trump. From previous convention acceptance speeches. And the odd thing about this is this, as you have pointed out, this was an extremely well-produced convention. They got the message across that they wanted to transmit, and they did it succinctly, and they did it in a tightly scripted way until they got to the closing night. And the whole idea of having your candidate make their speech is to make their speech in prime time on national television. And his speech didn't start until 10:30 on the East Coast and ended slightly after midnight on the East Coast. A lot of people didn't see it. How do you explain that?
How do you explain anything that's gone on in the 2024 campaign? I mean,
okay. So meanwhile, former South Carolina governor, ambassador to the United Nations in the Trump administration, and former presidential candidate Nikki Haley also spoke at the Republican convention this week. She had not been invited prior to the assassination attempt last weekend, but the party pivoted so they could stress the need for unity, and suddenly she was there. Yeah. Haley rubbed Trump the wrong way during the primaries because of what she said then about him.
He is not the same person he was in 2016. He is unhinged. He is more diminished than he was.
It's not normal to insult our military heroes and veterans. It's not normal to spend $50 million in campaign contributions on personal court cases. It's not normal to threaten people who back your opponent. And it's not normal to call on Russia to invade NATO countries. Donald Trump has done all of that.
I have said multiple times, I don't think it's good for the country for Donald Trump to become president again. I've made that very clear.
But at the convention, she sang a different song.
I'll start by making one thing perfectly clear. Donald Trump has my strong endorsement, period.
It is astounding to me that these people don't know that we have tape. This is a breathtakingly blatant example of hypocrisy. That's the only way to talk about it, isn't it?
It's a big club, yes.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, she certainly is not making history in this area of 6 months later saying, you know, the person that was the worst thing on earth is now the best thing on earth. So I think it goes back to part of what you were saying, though, Mike, unity and the succinct message and the way that this convention was disciplined in many ways right up until the end. So she did exactly what I think Donald Trump and the Republican Party would want her to do, which is to say, yeah, we have differences, but this is the best person to run the country. So she did what they wanted her to do.
And this is a change, I think, from Trump campaigns of past, right? We know that a guy with ties to former Governor Pat McCrory, actually Chris LaCivita, a Republican political strategist, is one of the two people kind of the top of the Trump campaign this cycle. And what we've seen is a much more disciplined, in spite of what you pointed out, you know, with everything was late in spite of a 90-minute speech, but this is still more disciplined than previous Trump campaigns. And we saw after the assassination attempt last week, we saw the pivot. Let's get some unity. Let's have a change in tone. And so I would say that is an evolution. And to continue the theme, as we talked about Nikki Haley, a politician being a hypocrite, never.
To be fair, she did hedge that unequivocal endorsement if you took the time to read between the lines, but then she quickly moved on.
We should acknowledge that there are some Americans who don't agree with Donald Trump 100% of the time. I happen to know some of them. And I want to speak to them tonight. My message to them is simple. You don't have to agree with Trump 100% of the time to vote for him. Take it from me. I haven't always agreed with President Trump. But we agree more often than we disagree.
And she also told the delegates they have to be open to expanding their party. She said, quote, "We are so much better when we are bigger. We are stronger when we welcome people into our party who have different backgrounds and experiences." How was that message and her presence received by the delegates?
You know, her speech overall, I think, was received pretty well. I think there was a mention of maybe some light boos or something like that, but mostly it was positively received. As for that last part, the bigger tent, the more diverse party, haven't heard a lot of reaction response to that. And remember, Trump took control of the Republican Party right after the Romney loss and the call for a much broader, more diverse party. And instead of going in that direction, they went to Trump. So, you know, based on what we've seen, I wouldn't expect that message to resonate a whole great deal anytime soon.
They had to kind of reshape this entire convention because of the assassination attempt last Saturday. The convention opened 2 days, not even a full 2 days after that assassination attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania, against Donald Trump at his rally there. And with every passing day, more questions are raised about how this could have happened, the role of the Secret Service, the local state police in Pennsylvania, who are also in charge of security there, and how the gunman got in, how his shooting position wasn't identified and guarded by authorities, et cetera, et cetera. North Carolina Senior Senator Tom Tillis is among congressional leaders calling for an investigation. But Tillis rejects all the conspiracy theories that have now sprung up around that event.
I believe that it's on people like me to continue to, number one, lead by example and call people out when they're being stupid. To the people who think it was some sort of a conspiracy, give me a break.
And Tillis added that this was not the result of someone's honest mistake. Quote, "somebody has to be held responsible," end quote. But by saying that it isn't an honest mistake, isn't he feeding into conspiracy theories that someone knew about or aided the shooter in some special way? You guys were on the call, right?
Senator Tillis, sorry, go ahead, Alex.
I don't think so. I think he's just more so concerned with what went wrong either in Secret Service or with law enforcement and who messed up here. I think he has a lot of questions about why the building wasn't secure and how they were able to just get away with it.
But couldn't that have been an honest mistake? Can you not hold somebody accountable for an honest mistake?
No, and Senator Tillis's point on that call, because let's be clear, I actually was kind of struck by the effort Senator Tillis made in that availability to kind of call out January Sixers for political violence and talk about folks in Milwaukee for political violence in the past and saying it all needs to stop and it's all too heated. I thought that was notable for a Republican to note that in their remarks on this topic. But his point was this being a Secret Service agent and guarding a former president, a presidential candidate, is a zero fail mission. And you cannot mess up, and there is no honest mistake for failing to secure a roof line.
What about the hundreds of congresspeople whose lives were put in jeopardy on January 6th? Was that an honest mistake not to have more security at the Capitol, or not to call up more security when it became obvious what was going on? And who's to blame for that honest mistake?
He didn't know. Let's point out he was calling January 6th unacceptable as well, and I again think it was notable for a Republican in an elected office in 2024 to, you know, still be citing January 6th as something that's unacceptable. I'm not saying it should be notable, but I'm saying we don't hear a lot from Republicans about that these days.
So we are getting reports on a different kind of political race, and that is the race for money, fundraising, in the contest for the governor's office between Attorney General Josh Stein, the Democrat, and Republican Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. Stein is outpacing him in terms of fundraising. Steve, by how much?
Well, the at the end of the second quarter, Stein has nearly $16 million left to spend. Robinson has $6.5 million left to spend. And really up and down in the Council of State races, Democrats are doing really well raising money. They're not leading in every race, but they're leading in many of them. And I think this speaks a little bit to here in North Carolina and nationally, the Democratic base is fired up. I mean, they're engaged. The problem for the party has been in terms of kind of these low propensity voters who are drifting away from them, who aren't engaged. But in the money race right now, they are doing very well.
So where's the money coming from? Is it coming from out of state? Is it coming from in-state? Is it coming from major donors? Is it coming from small $15, $10 checks? Where's it coming from?
I think all of the above. And in the Stein-Robinson race, I mean, this is really a national race. I wouldn't say that Josh Stein himself is a prolific fundraiser or a huge magnetic personality, but because he's running against Mark Robinson, this race has received enormous attention nationwide. So people are giving across the country. You know, in the attorney general's race between Jeff Jackson and Dan Bishop, Jackson is a certified star in the party, and he is also raising money nationally. So
a lot of
the answer
is
a little bit of all the above.
But we do not have a report on from that campaign on Jackson's fundraising efforts. So we do know that the Republican, Dan Bishop, in that race reports he's raised a total of $2.98 million. Why no report from Jackson?
We do have Jackson. Yeah. He's $4.2 million and $5.7 okay. million on hand. Yeah,
I could not find it yesterday. So yeah. There you go. Good. I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear that we have a report. But where is the money being spent? Is it being spent on social media advertising, on television, radio? How are they spending all this money?
You know, the governor's race, both candidates are up on TV pretty heavy right now. Mm. I mean, I'm at my gym, you know, with the bank of TVs on the wall, and every time I turn my head, I mean, not every time, but there are ads for both candidates frequently.
And is money being raised a good indication of how that translates to votes counted later on? We'll talk about that and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is with us. He's our political reporter here at WFAE News. Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter at WBTV. Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Alexandria Sand is with us. She's a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Before we move on from politics, another fundraising note. Another Democrat also is ahead in fundraising, and that is Democrat Nicole Sidman. She's outraising her Republican incumbent opponent, Trish Cotham, in the race for a North Carolina House seat. There's a lot of angry Democrats out there who felt betrayed and vowed vengeance when Trish Cotham switched parties from Democrat to Republican and gave the Republicans their unvetoable or their veto-proof supermajority, let's put it that way. Is this retribution for that? This fundraising?
Sure it is. Sure it is. Gangbuster? Yeah. I mean, yeah, this is the district that they are hell bent on on winning. And Steve knows it better than I do, but I think this is absolutely expected in this race.
So yeah, does money say, race translate to votes?
One thing I was looking at with these campaign finance reports, I went back 2 years ago to the election. There were six statewide judicial races on the ballot in North Carolina. The Democrats raised more money in almost all of them. So they had the fundraising advantage then, and Republicans won all six. So Democrats are doing what they need to do, but it's not necessarily going to mean they win.
Is that because of the messaging not working, or is it because of gerrymandering? They can't win.
I mean, I think it's just the national environment. I think that in a year when President Biden is unpopular, that you know, national politics drives everything in today's world. That is, you know, people, all things are national is kind of the new phrase. And so it's really hard to overcome those headwinds when you're a Democrat at the bottom of the ballot.
Mike, money certainly helps, and money can be a determining factor, but I don't think money is the determining factor. What can be the determining factor, though, is motivation. And so what you really have in the Cotham race is motivation for people who are really angry with her. I'd use stronger language, but we're on NPR, as we heard from Peter Sagal's fill-in this week. And so they're motivated to give money to her opponent. But that same thing that's motivating all those dollars, and that goes back to what Steve was saying about the national politics right now, right? What is going to be, what is a hot button issue in 2024? We know it's abortion rights and women's rights, right? Following the Supreme Court decision. And so that all is, I think, the motivation is leading to the big dollar amount for her opponent. And I also think it could, we don't know yet, but it could lead to bigger turnout for her opponent as well.
Eric,
just one side note that Steve and I have talked about this, and he should mention it on air, which is why I'm going to mention it to him right now. The rate of Democratic voter registration, not good. That's obviously a much bigger factor in the state. And Steve, you can fill in the details, but I think that is notable.
Yeah, just that 4 months out before an election in past elections, both parties, both Republicans and Democrats, start adding new voters at this time. People start getting engaged and signing up to vote. In 2024, we're seeing that on the Republican side, that their numbers are growing. Democrats are still losing registered voters. It's something that, you know, I'm kind of waiting to see when people get dialed in and get excited, and hasn't happened yet.
Well, it's hard to get excited if people universally don't like either of the front-running candidates. It will be interesting to see what happens if Joe Biden is pushed out of this race. CMS leaders are standardizing what teachers get paid for taking on extra duties like band and drama and dance and yearbook and other academic clubs. They've published a new pay schedule that does not include athletics, but what will it mean for these teachers if this pay schedule goes through? And I'm assuming that it will.
Yeah, I'm going to paraphrase and cut this down pretty simply here. That means your football coaches and athletic folks who spend a lot of time coaching and get compensated mm-hmm. for it will get paid for spending the same amount of time doing extracurriculars that your debate coaches and science Olympiad coaches and theater teachers would spend the same time or more time supporting kids and not getting equal pay for that. And it's something that my high school debate coach, Nicole Jenkins, who taught me in Fayetteville but now works in CMS, has been railing against. And I think of people like her who spent every weekend during the school year with me at debate tournaments could suddenly, you know, be getting $200 stipends a year.
$200 a year? Wow. Several months ago, some teachers and students told the school board that teachers were being paid for these extracurricular activities was not enough. And CMS says they are promoting equity with this standardization. I don't understand that. Explain that to me. How does this address equity?
Bad radio by throwing up my hands.
Okay, well, that's great radio. I love it. Habitat for Humanity in the Charlotte region announced this week that they would merge with Habitat Gaston County to become Habitat for Humanity of the Charlotte region. So why this move, Eric?
The main reason for the move is that combining forces will give them strength both in numbers and help the finances, particularly in Gaston County. They don't have anywhere near the construction manpower that's needed, but they do have land to build houses. You can see what the problem is there. So that's part of the reason that these groups are now merged, and they will cover Gaston, Iredell, Mecklenburg counties, about 230 employees and 1,100 mortgages under their purview.
Well, you may have just answered my next question, because nobody's being laid off.
No one's being laid off. No,
according, no staff reduction. According to Habitat Gaston County Board Chair Pat Mumford, they initiated the merger, while Habitat Charlotte Region CEO Laura Belcher says that the two organizations' strengths and weaknesses complement each other. The budget of the merged organization will increase by $1.5 million. That means they'll have a total operating budget of $52 million, but it's being spread over the same area that it covered as two distinct organizations. So is it simply that Gaston's version of Habitat has more available land to build on, and that's what they're bringing to the table here?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of what they're bringing. And, of course, anytime, even though there are not staff reductions, anytime you consolidate, there are typically some efficiencies, so maybe they can save some money as well and have a little bit more of a united front, although I can't imagine that anyone is against Habitat for Humanity, right, so to speak.
So we've been getting glimmers of hope in recent weeks over the acceptance of our long-suffering, long-stalled mobility transportation plan, whatever you want to call it. The latest glimmer of hope comes from the head of the Metropolitan Transit Commission. Lee Altman says that although she harbors misgivings about making policy concessions with the state legislature, she believes the plan will win their needed approval. Steve, why?
Well, the big reason is that, that they've really changed the plan significantly and are going to spend only 40% of the sales tax money on rail transit. That's the main issue. 40% will go directly to roads, only 40% for trains. And as we've talked about on the show many times, you know, Phil Berger and Tim Moore have said repeatedly that they want a roads first plan. And now Charlotte and the business community has finally served up a roads first
plan. Yes. We talked about this last week when you were not on the program. Ned Curran, among others, have come up with this proposal, I think, for the legislature, which would give the legislature a voice in this plan. Is that what she's talking about when Lee Altman says she has some misgivings?
Well, yeah, she was referring to essentially the entire North Carolina government structure, in that local always has to cede power. For example, just to have the referendum for the penny sales tax increase that's needed to fund this. So what she was saying is some of us may have to hold our noses, but it's worth it to finally make some progress, some significant progress on transit and transportation. And it's interesting, Mike, that what is this 2 weeks in a row? First, we had the city manager speaking to a business group, and now we have Lee Altman speaking and all the other things that are going on. It does feel like there is some momentum building, or at least a campaign building, to try and finally get this done.
And of course, like there's a lot of discussion between some of the different city managers happening behind the scenes that I think is important, but we don't really know what's being said. But we did hear Marcus Jones said that they were not always agreeing, but they were talking.
And this still won't make it to a ballot referendum for permission to raise the tax, the sales tax, by what, a penny or whatever it is, until November 24th. At the earliest, because it requires state approval for us to even have a referendum to ask that question. We have, Alex, been kicking this can down the road for a decade or more. In fact, Charlotte has had transit plans for decades, plural, that were developed and then largely ignored. This week, you took a look at those plans and at what Charlotte would be like today had we acted on them then. What did you find?
Yeah, it's interesting that now we're looking at 2025 for this long-awaited sales tax increase referendum, because by 2025, we were supposed to have a lot of these projects accomplished. So I wanted to look back at those plans. There was one plan in 1998 that gets referenced a lot that refers to 2025. But even before that, in the 90s, there were multiple books done that had maps of Charlotte. And they showed that Uptown was one central core, and there were supposed to be five light rails going from uptown out to the different cities. And the idea was that development would happen along these lines, kind of how it has on the Blue Line, and that the single family housing would fill in the wedges. And this was kind of unprecedented at the time to combine planning land use with transit. And just over the years, it's morphed and morphed. And we've seen that at an accelerated rate over these past 4 years with the Charlotte Move study and how that's changed.
So this 1990s regional source book identified these five corridors, and we've been talking about these five corridors for a very long time. Most of them have disappeared into the mists of time. The Red Line may be one of those corridors that comes to fruition after what recently happened with Norfolk Southern. But had we acted on them, it would have been cheaper to do it then than it will be to do it now, and we can't do it now because there's no money. But had we done it, would we be better off today, or would we simply be different?
I think we would be better off because you're considering all the benefits of public transit, the environmental benefits. You would have all that development kind of concentrated in that corridor. You'd be able to move people more easily.
So you spoke with Michael Gallus, who's a planner who helped advise the city back when these plans were being developed, and you asked him to describe where we are today, and he had the book of the plan with him, and he flipped to the page that was labeled unplanned. That's where we are today. Explain that.
I think he thinks it's unplanned because, I mean, just look at Uptown alone. The Red Line isn't going to touch the Blue Line. So you're asking people to walk across Uptown if they want to connect between those two. And then we don't even know about the Silver Line. People will say they want it to go through Uptown. Do we want to wrap around Uptown? Is it even going to go to the airport? So it seems like we had a lot of research done in the 90s that mapped out how this should work. And then today we're still questioning what everything should be.
And still spending money on studying, and when we have a plan in print right now. Ownership changes for Charlotte Pro Team seem to be the order of the day. The Panthers changed ownership. The Hornets changed ownership just a couple of weeks ago. The Charlotte Knights changed hand, and now the Charlotte Checkers kind of flipped. I think minority ownership became majority ownership and vice versa. Alex, what do they envision for hockey in Charlotte with this new change?
Yeah, it seems like the Checkers are going through a growing period. Bojangles Coliseum, it's kind of cool and retro, but it really needs an upgrade soon. And they're talking about doing a standalone practice facility and making a ice rink there that the whole community could use, which would be nice for people that like to skate in Charlotte because the closest ice rink is in Pineville. I think the other one's in Indian Trail. So
will they be asking for city money, county money for that community ice rink, which will also be their practice facility?
Oh, Mike.
I'm just asking.
It just hurts my heart that you instantly go there. But yes, of course. That's what they've done in Jacksonville and Savannah, so I think it's a pretty good shot that it'll happen here too.
We were told a couple of months ago to much a ballyhoo that Ballantyne was getting a grocery store. I thought they already had one, but they're getting Wegmans. So as a trade-off for that, Noda is also getting a grocery store. This time it's Sprouts Farmers Market on 36th Street, just off North Tryon. This will come about, next year, sometime next summer. This is a big deal, evidently, because that's one of the, I didn't know this, but that's described as one of Charlotte's food deserts. Right, Alex?
Yeah, it's the closest grocery store is the Food Lion or the Giant Penny. So people in Noda have been waiting a long time, especially because it's kind of a walkable area. People want to be able to walk or bike to get their groceries. So this Sprouts is definitely long awaited.
So we have a passing of note to mention today. Longtime Charlotte Observer reporter turned columnist Nancy Bracci died. She was 80. She started her career back in Florida in the 60s and then came to the Observer in 1969. Did you have an opportunity to work with her, Steve, at the Observer when you were there?
I did, yes. Our time overlapped, and I think she's best known. She wrote a book in 2000, Nancy Bracci's Guide to Piedmont Gardening, which I think got a huge following.
She had an amazing gardening column every week in The Observer for the longest time. And I asked her when I was at another radio station to do a Saturday morning gardening talk show. We had lunch several times. We talked about it. And she ultimately said no because she liked the freedom afforded by writing, editing, and rewriting. She didn't want to do it on the fly. And she was a great writer. Finally, Charlotte Talks bids farewell to our summer intern, Emmy Berger, today, who came to us from UNC Wilmington. We put her to work. We want to thank her for a job well done and wish her the best as she goes on back to school and wherever her professional life may take her. Steve Harrison, Alexandria Sands, Nick Oxner, Eric Spanberg, thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.